Welcome, everyone. I am Bob Wurzelwalker, the director of the Respect Life Office for the Archdiocese of Cincinnati, and this is our video podcast series that we call Being Pro-Life. This is part of a series we're producing on the new ballot initiative in the state of Ohio coming in November of 2023 to amend the Ohio Constitution to include something called the right to reproductive freedom. And in this series, we're going to discuss what the amendment says, why it is so dangerous for Ohio, and how you can get involved to educate the public. Today's guest is Philip Williamson, a lawyer in Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky, who spent time with Alliance Defending Freedom, learning about the ins and outs of laws regarding pro-life issues, and currently serves on the board of Ohio Right to Life. Philip, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
All right. So a few months ago, we did have Peter Range, director of Ohio Right to Life, on the show and discussed some of the dangers of the ballot initiative, the language of the ballot initiative. He talked about the big three dangers, the loss of parental rights, elimination of many medical safety standards for women, and abortion for any reason for all 9 months. So we can touch on those briefly as kind of a refresher, I think, for our listeners. And then I want to get into some more issues that I heard you talk about before with your expertise in pro-life law. But let's start with one of those big issues that I think a lot of people would be concerned about, parental notification. So why are we claiming that this amendment will strip away parental rights to have a say in the decisions of their children?
Well, it's in Section B of the amendment where it says the state shall not burden a person's voluntary exercise of their right to make reproductive decisions. And it's that word burden. So in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and you can read this yourself, the Supreme Court said you can't place an undue burden on abortion access. And it described a number of things as burdens, including laws requiring parental consent or parental notification. Those are considered, under Casey, burdens, though they were constitutional at the time because they were not undue. Well, this amendment takes that word undue out of the equation. It just forbids burdens. So you can go back to Casey and ask the question, well, what's a burden? Parental notification is on that list. Parental consent is on that list. And that's why we say this amendment would eliminate parental notification laws.
Wow. In addition to that, right, there's also language about it doesn't use the word woman or the word adult in any place as well. It simply says individual to add to that context that an individual of any age, basically, right, should have a right to reproductive choices.
This is a fight we've been having with our pro-abortion friends since the beginning. We've always had kind of some background fight about parental notification, parental consent. That's a question that's been in front of the Supreme Court almost half a dozen times at this point.
So you talked about burden. I think that very same change from undue burden to burden, that's also going to have an effect on safety standards for women. They're going to be in danger if this amendment passes that are normally in place for various other kinds of surgical procedures.
Absolutely. So here's an important one. Ohio, like many states, has a waiting period. If you're seeking an abortion, the state will make you wait 24, 48, maybe 72 hours in some places between sort of asking for an abortion and obtaining it. And the reason is that a vast majority of women report feeling some kind of pressure to get an abortion. And the purpose of a waiting period is to give you a chance to pause, take a break, and not be forced to make a decision under that kind of intense pressure of what is often a terrifying and lonely situation. It's right. A safety valve. But it's a safety valve that, again, if you go back to Casey, is described as a burden on abortion. Again, constitutional under Casey and some other decisions because it's not undue. But once you take that word undue out of the equation, the way that this amendment does, we have all kinds of safety protections that are unavailable. Clinic regulations, things like requiring an abortion clinic to meet the same health and safety standards as an ambulatory surgical center, an outpatient surgical center. We've gone up to the Supreme Court multiple times over whether those types of laws are undue burdens on abortion access. And again, when you take the word undue out of the equation, these kinds of health and safety laws are also forbidden under this amendment.
It sounds like a pizza place might have more health regulations than an abortion center if this kind of, and it sounds kind of, that might sound funny, but seriously, you got a lot of health regulations, right? About places, your surgical center, emergencies happen. Some of these laws, as I understand it, might be things like that connect a doctor. They have ambulatory privileges to the nearest hospital, for example, right? Or how wide the hallway is, right? They fit a gurney into, for example, that those kinds of things that that abortion centers often fight as a burden to abortion access.
Yes. In fact, the last time abortion was in the Supreme Court before Dobbs overturned Roe versus Wade, the fight was over an admission privileges requirement in Texas and in Louisiana, where the state said, look, yeah, if you're going to operate an abortion clinic, if you're going to perform abortions, you need to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital, which allows for a more seamless transition of a patient to the care of a hospital if something goes wrong. And abortion providers fight these types of requirements tooth and nail, sometimes because hospitals don't want to work with them because they're dealing in death, and sometimes because these abortion providers are not actually up to the standards of care that the hospital requires to maintain a professional relationship.
Right. Similar to this, I think of chemical abortion. So right now in Ohio, not in all states, but in Ohio, you have to have an in-person visit with a provider before you can get that chemical abortion, but can't be mailed to you, you know, with or have a virtual, you know, meeting, for example. But I would imagine the rule that says you have to visit a doctor in person would go away if this amendment passes. Thus, for example, if you only have to visit a doctor with an online visit and you're being coerced, that person coercing you could be right on the other side of the camera. It's very different from if you're walking alone into that center, the person coercing you, if they're not there, that might be your only opportunity to let people know what's going on. Would you agree that's the kind of thing that could also be removed with this amendment? Those kind of safety things that make sure the woman might even be alone away from their coercer if they're seeking an abortion?
Absolutely. Like I said before, the waiting periods, we know that the majority of women report feeling some kind of pressure or coercion to having an abortion. One of the reasons why you require an in-person doctor visit is so that a woman is able to have a conversation and make a decision without that immediate pressure that's coming from another person, you know, right next to her. I'm a lawyer. We hate taking remote depositions for exactly the reason you said, which is you want to be able to see the person you're deposing face to face and to make sure they're not getting coached or pressured or fed lines from someone else in the room. And when you're doing it remotely, it's so much harder to make sure that the room is empty and that you're having an honest conversation. And so what our friends on the other side want for abortion is something that we lawyers hate for trial preparation for many of the same reasons.
Right. The last big thing to talk about, proponents remind us that the language of the amendment does specifically mention that abortion could be limited after viability. But at the same time, we are saying that this amendment will actually allow for abortions for virtually any reason for all 9 months. So take us through why that is the case.
Sure. And it's basically the pro-abortionist hoping that you don't read the entire amendment for yourself. So the amendment does say that the state can prohibit abortion or restrict abortion after viability. The very next sentence says, in no case can the state restrict any abortion if, and it's a great piece of legalese here, the professional judgment of the pregnant patient's treating physician that abortion is necessary to preserve the pregnant person's life or health. This is what happens, by the way, when you're not willing to say, you know, mother or baby. Who's the pregnant patient's treating physician? It's the abortionist. So in no case can the state restrict an abortion if the abortionist says that it's necessary to preserve the mother's life or health. Well, we know a few things about abortionists in Ohio. We know, number one, they have actually argued in Ohio in court in the last 18 months or so that abortion is safer than childbirth. So when abortionists sued to challenge the heartbeat bill, the 6-week abortion ban, the complaint they filed in Hamilton County Common Pleas, and you can read it for yourself, I think it's paragraph 31, they say abortion is actually safer than carrying a baby to term. The other thing that's important to know is that phrase life or health, it's not just sort of an emergency where you think a woman might die in the next, you know, 10 minutes if she doesn't have an abortion. It's a definition they borrow from Roe versus Wade that includes mental, emotional, financial, familial health. Bottom line is, if the abortionist says having a baby is going to make this woman sad, or if she already has too many kids, or it's, you know, going to make her poorer, She can have the abortion every single time.
This is the person who gets paid to do the abortion. That's the person making this decision.
That's right. You're going to have a person who believes abortion is safer than pregnancy, who only gets paid if the woman has an abortion, making the decision about whether the abortion is legal.
And, you know, it's interesting, even that point that if they believe that abortion is safer than pregnancy, then right there, there is even a supposed physical health reason for this abortion is better for her because it's safer than having her carry to term. Oh, my goodness. So virtually any reason. There isn't a woman that could walk into an abortion center and come up with a reason that's not good enough for an abortionist to have the abortion. It also includes in there, you cannot burden the person who assists or the entity who assists the individual exercising this right. Who are we talking about there that this amendment is protecting?
Well, the most obvious is the abortion clinic or the abortionist itself. This is the pro-abortion industry trying to protect itself and giving itself some rights under this amendment. But it's going to include anyone who might be involved in the process. So there are organizations that will fly or drive women across state borders to get an abortion if they don't live close to a clinic. This is the high school basketball coach who impregnates one of his players, drives her to an abortion clinic, sits in his car in the parking lot, so doesn't go in and isn't identified as a perpetrator, drives her back to her parents' house without telling anyone what's happened. Anyone who assists means exactly what it says, which is anyone who assists.
And all these people are protected now. We focus this podcast on, just like we did some of the other previous episodes, on how this amendment relates specifically to abortion. Even if you're pro-choice, you would be against most of these things that would follow from this amendment, getting rid of parental notification laws, making abortions even less safe by getting rid of the health and safety standards that we currently have here in Ohio and make it legal for all reasons, basically for all 9 months. But there's also reason to believe, right, that this is about more than abortion. So let's talk about some of that deceptive language right up front that has people wanting to vote for it, but not realizing what they're actually voting for. You could walk us through some of that language.
Sure. So the thing you're talking about, Section A of the amendment, when it sort of defines this right to make reproductive decisions, which according to the amendment itself is including but not limited to things like carrying your pregnancy to term, miscarriage care, fertility care, and abortion at the end of this list. What the pro-abortionists are trying to do with this list is convince you that you have to vote for abortion in order to vote for all of these other things that many of us agree are good and already enjoy the right to do. You have always had the right to carry your pregnancy to term. You have always had a right to miscarriage care. None of that changes, with a yes or no vote on this amendment. But the pro-abortionists want you to think, in order to have a right to carry your baby to term, you also have to vote for a right to kill it. That's just not true. The other reason for concern is that phrase, including but not limited to. You ought to ask, well, including what else? And there's some pretty good analysis that the phrase reproductive decision is probably broad enough to include whatever it is you want to do with your reproductive organs, including, put it delicately, trading for another set. You'll also notice that the amendment never commits itself to the idea that only women can get pregnant. You will not find the word woman or mother in this amendment. It's pregnant patient or pregnant person, which should tell us something about how the pro-abortionists think about sex and gender.
So, Philip, why don't we talk about that series, some of the cases and how it is that even things that we thought were initially only related to abortion in federal law, right, or in court cases with the Supreme Court, lead us to believe that these are all tied together with today's gender identity issues that we hear so much about.
Sure. If you start with a case in the 1960s called Griswold versus Connecticut, you can kind of see the way the sexual revolution has made a march and an evolution through just Supreme Court decisions. So in the 1960s, the Supreme Court decides Griswold versus Connecticut, which creates a constitutional right to use contraception. And the court talks about this right to privacy, doesn't know where in the Constitution to find it, but it's in there somewhere, that includes a right to make intimate decisions. Well, you move to 73, to Roe versus Wade, and the court cites Griswold for this idea that there's a right to privacy that includes the right to make all of these intimate decisions, which includes a right to abortion. You see that reaffirmed in Planned Parenthood versus Casey in the 1990s that makes this sort of right to make intimate decisions kind of a core part of your being. You go to 2003 to a case called Lawrence versus Texas when the Supreme Court finds a right to homosexual sodomy. And in that decision, it relies heavily on Roe and Casey and this idea of a freedom to make intimate decisions. You move to the 2010s with Windsor versus United States, and then with Obergefell versus Hodges, which gave us same-sex marriage, again relying on this same language about privacy and making intimate decisions. And so by the time we sort of finish this evolution and you get to Bostock, that's where you have the whole intellectual architecture to talk about sexual identity and sexual orientation as being the same thing as sex or gender. And so it's our friends on the other side have seen sort of singular evolution from contraception and a right to make intimate decisions to transgenderism and the sort of zenith of the sexual revolution. And we have to recognize that intellectual architecture they're putting together too.
So we've talked a little bit about transgender issues then and why it is that the language of this amendment could easily be included in various decisions related to what people do who suffer with some kind of gender dysphoria, I'd like to say. But how realistic do you, as a lawyer, would you say it is to say that something like transgender surgery could happen to minors without parental consent even or notification, something that normally happens with a minor with any kind of surgery? This could happen related to transgender surgery without parental notification if this amendment goes through.
Well, because there are a number of states where you're already seeing this happen, where kids are getting cross-gender hormones, puberty blockers, chest binders, and the like at school or from school nurses who don't want to communicate this with the parents. You can look at Planned Parenthood's own reporting of its own activities, and you're seeing a massive uptick in what they call gender-affirming care, that is transgender medication, in the last 5 to 10 years. The folks at Planned Parenthood see these things as related, and as I think I talked about with one of the earlier sections of the amendment, this amendment is designed in part to protect abortion providers. They're not out to protect just part of their business and not the whole thing.
What else do you think is important that for people to know about this amendment that we haven't, because I've asked you pretty direct questions. Why don't I just open it up to stuff that I didn't specifically ask you, but I think is important to, for the listeners to know about the language of this amendment?
I think there are two important things to keep in mind. Number one, if you take away nothing else, it's that part of Section B, where it's the abortion provider making the decision from the moment of conception until the baby is born about whether it is permissible to abort that baby. A person who has been paid to kill the baby gets to decide whether it's okay to kill the baby.
Right.
Everything else in this amendment is distraction and window dressing. That's really the key piece. The second thing is pro-lifers need to be confident as we are doing battle with this amendment. You're going to get bullied. You're going to get pushed back. You're going to get described as narrow-minded or bigoted or anti-woman or anti-choice or, take your pick of insults. Here's the problem. The only thing the pro-abortion side can offer is death. That's it. That's the whole business model. That's the whole offering. There are no other choices. When they say pro-choice, what they mean is the solution to all of your problems is have you considered taking a prescription for death? They fight against all of the choices other than death. They fight against parental notification and parental consent because some parents might say, no, you're not choosing death. They fight against waiting periods and informed consent requirements and health and safety provisions for hospitals. They fight against in-person visits because you take a woman who's already in a terrifying and lonely situation and you begin to isolate her from all of the support network and all of the community and all of the options that might give her a chance to choose life, and you leave her isolated and alone and told that the only person she can trust is the guy in the white coat on the other side of the table who's only going to get paid if she chooses to kill her baby. That is the business model. It's not about choice. It's about selling death. We're the ones who have a real choice to offer, and we have to be bold and confident in telling women, no, you can in fact choose life. You are a mother who can choose life. You can do this, and we are here to help. Do you need a car seat? Because is that the hang up? We can do that. Do you need a crib? Do you need baby clothes? Do you need diapers? Do you need parenting classes? Do you just need someone who can come and hold your child when they're crying at 2 a.m? We can be there, but death is not the answer to life's problems.
Great. All right, Phil. Well, thanks for educating us on all of those things dangerous about the amendment. So what can the regular person in the pew, we might say, right, do to help stop this from happening in Ohio in November?
Well, I'd say maybe three key things. Number one, make sure that you register to vote and that your ballot gets in. Early voting starts on October 11th. So register to vote, make sure you get your ballot in, whether you're voting absentee, voting by mail, you're planning to show up in person, either for early voting or on election day, but make sure that your ballot gets in. Number two, if you have the means, resources, and want to help out, you can donate to Protect Women Ohio, which is the organization that's kind of running point on the campaign for voting no in November. And number three, support women and men in your community who are making the choice to choose life every single day. You can choose abortion once, and you know they'll tell you that at that point it's over. Choosing life is a decision that we make every single day, over and over and over again. So give to your local pregnancy resource center. Volunteer at a pregnancy resource center. Be a real presence and support for the men and women in our community who need our help and our support to choose life. But if you do any one of those three things, I think we'll feel pretty good about November.
All right. Well, thanks for talking with us today, Philip, about issue one in November that could enshrine a right to abortion for any reason up until birth. It could remove parental rights and notifications, as well as most reasonable health and safety standards related to it, and even so many other things not even related to abortion. I hope I can bring you on again in November to talk about a big victory for Ohio. That's what I hope.
I certainly hope so.
All right. But thank you for coming on today.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
I want to thank all our viewers and listeners for tuning in on this episode of our Being Pro-Life series. Head to the website to view all the links talked about in this episode at www.catholicaoc.org/beingprolife. Thank you again for joining us today. I look forward to being with you next time.